From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau, and we're talking again today about race in the Driftless area, race relations in Southwestern Wisconsin. We're trying to bring forward the voices, and we'll do better about this over time, but we're trying to bring forward more of the voices of people who have faced discrimination in the Cooley region or in other walks of their life, and share those stories with our listeners in light of everything that's been going on the last month or so. Joining us today is Dodie Whitaker, who lives in Viroqua and who's active in several different areas that we'll talk about throughout our community. First, let me welcome Dodie to the show. Dodie, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you're a musician and an activist, and you come from a family whose history is rich in the civil rights movement, and we're going to talk about all of that. But first of all, what I'm interested in first is just sort of this idea of becoming involved in activism on behalf of yourself and other African Americans who are trying to make a way in the United States. How did you first become aware that that was something that you felt like you should be involved in?
That's an interesting question. I can't remember a time when I wasn't pulled into particular causes or felt like that there was, a good reason to not get involved with a protest or something that just seemed like it was important. Yeah, both my parents were involved in the civil rights movement. I like to say that I was a child of the civil rights movement. I was born in 1968 to an interracial couple at a time when it was not legal for them to be married in all states. And I guess I should say they married in 1966. So they were married at a time when it was not legal, from 1967. I was born 6 months, maybe 5 months after Dr. King was assassinated. He and my dad had worked together. And after his assassination, my dad worked directly for Coretta Scott King, his widow, in Atlanta. And yeah, so I think any person of color, maybe born in the 60s, probably has some idea that things, are well won and also lots to be fought for still. So I remember in college, I did protests for anti-apartheid. If somebody made a joke I feel like I was always kind of one of those people that would stand up for the little guy. And, justice was very important to me. I used to say as a kid, it's just not fair. It's not fair.
Talking about some of the things that you're involved with in our area, you're a musician. You've been involved in the portrayal of historic African-American figures in the Cooley region and in the Driftless area. And you've been involved in other things as well. Talk about some of the projects that you've been involved with over the last years and how they've kind of helped you carry your message forward.
Well, it's interesting. I, as a performer, kind of growing up, coming through a time where there was a lot of prejudice and divisiveness. I grew up in the South Side of Chicago with surrounded by a lot of, primarily I would say black folks at my high school. My grade school was very mixed. I kind of grew up in areas where I didn't see as much that kind of direct overt racism. I knew that it existed, of course, and we were very well schooled in African American history, and in both in school and outside of school was just the books that we had and the stories we heard, and Roots was on television. There was enough going on, but at the flip side of that coin is that it was very mostly you didn't see yourself on TV, in the magazines. As a black woman, you just didn't see yourself represented. And so as I was coming up as a performer, that started to manifest itself in just practices that were prejudicial, you know, that were biased. I was often told I wasn't right for a role because of the color of my skin. Sometimes they'd say it directly, sometimes they wouldn't. And in fact, so the first historical person that I remember portraying was probably before that in high school. I did some reenactments. I remember I did Nikki Giovanni, the poet. But anyway, as a professional, I went into an audition not realizing that they were casting for two shows. I was auditioning for an opera that was not race related at all. Then they called me back and they asked me to portray Harriet Tubman in an opera. And I didn't know that it existed. And so that flip side of like, oh, they saw me and they saw an opportunity, you know, for something that I could do, quote unquote, you know, as opposed to singing Maria in The Sound of Music. And Julie Andrews was my idol, you know, but they wouldn't see that, you know. So I was both honored and also just perturbed by that whole situation, you know, because they saw me. They said, okay, she'd be perfect. I wonder why, you know. So, but then I did get to be a part of this really beautiful production where I led the characters to freedom, and they were all played by high schoolers, and it was a really lovely thing with the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. So that was really, really neat. And yeah, I would say after that, I was in an opera that portrayed free people who were on trial during the Amistad, historical, the ship where the people were captured. And so again, you know, I've had some really cool opportunities. And then recently, I've been able to portray a couple local Black historical figures from La Crosse based on the Enduring Families Project, which is based on some very extensive research into local Black history.
That's something I was hoping to talk to you about, the Enduring Families Project, because it's such a neat initiative. It's, if I'm not mistaken, it's kind of under the auspices of the Historical Society, La Crosse Historical Society. But talk about the character or characters that you've portrayed. Who are the people that whose lives you've brought to life?
Well, my first character was, oh gosh, I'm just blanking on her name. Excuse me. Her name was Elizabeth Burt. But she was ran a boarding house in La Crosse for quite a time, and actually took in children as she went. So there was this whole kind of underground, you know, society of folks that were supporting each other through having places to live. She and her husband had come through for the logging industry for her husband, and they both worked on the Mississippi River line. And so kind of that was able to paint a picture of how they made it to the La Crosse area. And she had a direct connection with Nathan Smith and how he took in kids and they were able to help kind of as a community raise kids to, you know, to aspire to anything that, you know, was available to them at that time. So that was a very, very important character. And then my other character, who I've been doing recently, Burletta Waldron, she's what came up, her grandparents came on a stagecoach or wagon to Cheyenne Valley. And so she and her sister were the first babies born in their family in Cheyenne Valley. And that, again, that's near Wildcat Mountain. That's, you know, history that I think a lot of people didn't know, that there was like a multiracial settlement of folks during that time as well. And so this is all kind of 1850s up through the early 1900s. And it's just fascinating history. So I feel really honored to be able to bring that to folks, not only in schools and educational settings. We've been to nursing homes, and most recently we were able to do that really wonderful walking tour for the weekend of Juneteenth.
And we're speaking with Dodie Whitaker, who is a musician, an actor, an activist, and has been involved in demonstrating on behalf of not only just civil rights, but on behalf of equality of African Americans and others discriminated against in our communities. And she's joining us today on Newsmakers. If you'd like more information about our program, if you'd like to hear a previous episode or to submit an idea or contact us for some other reason, you can find all that information at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our conversation with Dodie Whitaker continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking today with Dodie Whitaker, who is, I feel like I'm giving you short shrift, Dodie, because I know you do so many things, but you're a musician and an activist and an actor who has portrayed historic African-American characters as part of the Enduring Families Project in La Crosse. And but you're also, you live in Viroqua, which is a much more rural setting than even La Crosse is. And I want to talk to you about that experience, because it must be very different living in Viroqua versus where you grew up in Chicago. So compare those experiences, if you can, in terms of people's perception of racism and the different ways that it might exhibit itself in a bigger town like Chicago versus a smaller town like Viroqua.
Well, yeah, that's a big question. so just a little bit of history. We did live kind of just outside of Chicago in Oak Park, Illinois. That was kind of the last place that my family and I lived. It was a suburb of Chicago that is just west of downtown. And there are a few suburbs and neighborhoods in Chicago that are kind of known for being more racially mixed and progressive and tolerant. And so Oak Park is one of those. And so it was nice to be surrounded by people of lots of different races. Where I grew up on the south side of Chicago, again, in Hyde Park, it was kind of a similar situation. And so when we decided to move here, mostly because of a educational opportunity for my daughter with the Waldorf School, we already knew some people here, including my godchildren who are also people of color. And so I was able to kind of find out what it was like for them before we moved here. And I remember we bought our house in 2008, and I remember so many people being excited in Viroqua. This is kind of being described for me when Obama came to La Crosse. And so, you know, because this was the middle of his campaign before we moved here. And I remember thinking, oh, how lucky they are that they get to be so close to him. So like the benefits of having that kind of, you know, the small town experience where you can actually, you know, participate in things in a way that doesn't feel so anonymous or, you know, lost in the big city. So at the same time I was getting ready to move here with my family, I was participating in an opera downtown in Chicago of Porgy and Bess, which you may know is a very historical opera that was written by George Gershwin, and it takes place 100 years ago, but in an all-Black neighborhood. And so that was a very interesting experience to kind of be performing that at a time when things were seeming like they were shifting, you know, and they did for sure with our first Black president. And so I think I moved here at a time of quite a bit of optimism. Viroqua is very progressive. And of course there are people here that don't all share the same views. My experience here really has been quite positive in terms of how I just feel like it's so much based on around community. But at the same time, sure, things happen. I'm very aware that I probably get stopped by the police maybe a little bit more than some of my friends, some of my white friends. I've had people mistake me for another person of color who lives in the area, because there just aren't many of us. And, you know, so you're just aware of those little things. But I've been very fortunate that I really haven't had a lot of negative things happen to me here. In terms of that, as I was explaining before, I feel like more in the big wide world, there were more things that kind of kept me from having the career that I wanted and that kind of thing. Although I was very fortunate again. And so you're kind of always just treading that line between, you know, how much of a representative do I want to be? How much of my voice do I want to be heard? How much, you know, it can get very exhausting, I think, you know, just kind of being a person of color and in a world where, you know, you don't always know how you're going to be received or if somebody's reacting to you because of that or, you know, for any number of reasons. So again, my experience here probably hasn't been that much different, but at the same time, I feel very fortunate because I can actually get more involved since I've been here in terms of getting involved with these programs and projects. So right now I'm working with the Viro Club within the community. You know, I've been able to help organize some local protests and, you know, maybe called upon to use my voice in a positive way in terms of teaching a song from the African American tradition or, you know, literally writing something that, you know, or helping to write something that would support people who are trying to stand up for the causes. In this case, Black Lives.
You were in the involved in a march a few weeks ago in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. So many marches that we saw in protests of different kinds and have continued to see. But there was a march in Viroqua that was attended by at least a couple hundred people, maybe 250 or 300 people in Viroqua. And what struck me about that march is that, if I'm not mistaken, your father was there and your daughter was there as well. And so you have three generations of your family who are all involved in different aspects of civil rights activism. Your father having the historical connections that he did to Dr. King, yourself having worked in this for your whole life, essentially, and now you're passing it on to your children, including your daughter, who was one of the youth organizers for that event. What was that like to be at that march in Viroqua with three generations of your family represented there?
Yeah, it was pretty special. I was really proud of my dad for being able to, you know, that's kind of his profession, but still getting up in a community that he's quite new to, that is, you know, probably for him very different than where he's been living most of his life, which is mostly more African American communities. And then to be able to be there with both my children, actually. So I have a 14-year-old son as well. And he was kind of sitting to my left as my dad was up speaking. And as you mentioned, my daughter helped organize this rally. So there was an earlier rally that was mostly orchestrated by some folks on Facebook, some folks in their 20s. But my daughter's almost 18, that group, and they're all kind of graduating from high school, getting ready to be able to vote. And all of that. So it's a big deal. But in terms of just feeling so strongly that we wanted to have the voices of the young people as well. So within our small community, of course, you know, most of the people of color know each other. And so I was able to also be able to showcase a couple of the other young people in the area, and so they got up and spoke. So really people just had a lot of, you know, so much of it was orchestrated by those young people, but also really recognizing and centering the voice of an elder, you know, really as you said, kind of brings those generations together in a way that illustrates that this is a continuous fight and that we all just need to learn from each other and support each other and listen to one another.
So your father's generation had the ball from the 60s kind of moving forward, and then your generation coming after that, and now passing it on to the next generation. As you look at areas where society has made progress and areas where society has made less progress, as you're talking to your children about these issues, what do you think are the most important issues that children of their generation are going to have to face and going to have to fight for?
Oh, well, I mean, in a way, I would love for you to ask my daughter directly. She's not here right now. I'm over at my dad's. But, you know, I feel like the world is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, you know. But at the same time, what we're seeing right now is just this very stark moment, you know, of people kind of coming to a certain consciousness. And so I think it's a really exciting time for young people, for sure, because I think they're in a world where they've seen things like gay marriage, you know, become legal. And people all over the internet, you know, throwing in their support for Black Lives Matter. And of course, you know, on the flip side, seeing how people, you know, have any number of opinions. and so, you know, it's the same fight in a lot of ways. You've got to stand up for what you believe in. But I also feel like that they have this opportunity because they're coming into a world where they wouldn't necessarily have context for some of the, you know, the kind of the long history of violence and oppression. And so while they understand it, this is, you know, that those things have happened, it's almost like, well, but this is our world. You know, this is, we have this opportunity to fight and become a part of history, and you know, partly through social media, it's so much easier to say, okay, we're going to do a protest, you know, or we're going to sign this petition, or we're going to put up this photograph of somebody that we want to remember. So I think in a way, you know, they're very fortunate to have that, and they're also really inheriting, you know, a big weight, just like all young folks do. But it does really feel like, I mean, I was born in the 60s, but, you know, I don't remember them. But it does feel like that there is, you know, a momentum that's quite, you know, new to this generation or even my generation.
Dodie Whitaker, such a wide range of experiences that we've been able to talk with her about today on Newsmakers. Dodie, thank you very much for sharing your stories with us today and for joining us on the program.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you again. And, yeah, be well.
Thank you. Thank you. Dodie Whitaker joining us here today on Newsmakers. If you'd like to learn more about our program, let me remind you, you can check out our previous shows on our website. This show will be up there soon enough, and it's at wpr.org/newsmakers. And our program continues right after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwestern Bureau. Thank you for joining us today. We're continuing our conversation on racism in the Cooley region and throughout the Driftless area in our listening area in southwestern Wisconsin. And we turn now to a series of discussions taking place hosted by the Franciscan Spirituality Center, which is an outreach of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. And I'm pleased now to be joined by Jean Pagliaro with the Franciscan Spirituality Center and Sister Laura Nettles from the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Sister Laura, Jean, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
talking about racism in the Coulee region, the full title of your conversation series that's upcoming, we'll give more details later, but it's called Racism and the Coulee Region, a community dialogue series. What brought you, let's start with Gene, what brought you as a center to this topic, to this series?
You know, that was actually something that we were charged with by our sponsoring community, the FSPAs. One of our, part of our mission is to address what is happening in our time. And so, I mean, that's constantly on our minds as we're creating programs and retreats. And so, especially now with what has been happening in the Twin Cities and all over the place, we felt that this was a crucial time to address this and to create conversations around racism and violence and hatred. And we wanted it to be more than simply something where people receive information. We really want this to be conversations. We want this to be dialogue. We want to be learning and engaging. And so this has been, we have been given the green light all around to create what we need to create and have some flexibility within that to engage people in our community to participate in conversation.
Sister Laura, what makes this an important thing for you to be involved in?
Several years ago, the FSPA were, we gathered together as a large community, and we had an outside speaker who challenged us to look at our privilege and then the way that our privilege gets us by and gets us through things. And so we actually said a couple years ago, because of that challenge, that we wanted to address our privilege, and specifically white privilege. And that's what Gene had alluded to. And in doing so, you know, we've come to a place that we have to understand our privilege, but we realize that we need to do something. And that's what we see right now with our brothers and sisters who are standing in the streets, crying out to us and protesting and saying, do something, please help us. And so empowering the Spirituality Center to start a series of conversations really just sort of fit our mission and what we're about.
A few weeks ago, we had a gentleman on this program named Shondell Spivey, and he's with an organization called BLACK, which stands for Black Leaders Acquiring Collective Knowledge. They've been organizing several events active in the La Crosse area for a while, but especially in the last couple of months have organized and been involved in organizing some high-profile events here. And one of the things that stuck out with our conversation with him is that he I think rightly characterized racism as a white problem, that too often white people look to African Americans and other people of color to fix. And he said, white people certainly don't need our permission to address the issue of racism. So, Sister Laura, why is that an important thing, not just for FSPA as a largely white organization, but also other white-based organizations in our community to deal with head-on?
Well, you know, I'm glad that you had interviewed Chantel, because I think he's doing some fabulous work. And, you know, he's very clear that racism is a social construct that's been perpetuated and institutionalized by those in power, right? And that would be those of us who are white. And so for it to be dismantled, it has to be us. It has to be white people who are outraged enough to dismantle what was set up so many years ago. So we need to care about what's happening to our brothers and sisters. We need to care that people are dying. But we have to do more than just care. We are the ones that are responsible for dismantling, because it was our ancestors who were responsible for setting it up.
Laura, in looking at how to program a thing like this, how to whom to bring to the table, and what discussions need to be had, you've got 6 sessions here, and if I'm counting right, how do you decide what subjects are going to be addressed in those sessions?
So that is a matter of really a couple of factors. We use our, first and foremost, our contacts that we already have to reach out and invite people, especially the ones that we're really interested in are ones that are on the topic of racism and faith, and how, as a lot of our attendees are, they consider to be people of faith, whether that's the Christian faith or not Christian faith, but we say as people of faith, people that believe in a higher being. How does that, how as somebody of faith, how do we individually and collectively stand up against racism and learn ways? Like Sister Laura said, it is our responsibility as white people to educate and to be outraged and then to act. And so in order to do that, we are intentionally reaching out to local presenters, to local community members, and wanting to look locally for this particular series, and then maybe eventually reach out a little broader. But for right now, we're really focusing on the La Crosse Community Cooley region.
So you mentioned people of faith, but not only the Christian faith. This is not something that's geared toward a Catholic or even more widely Christian audience, but it's an ecumenical series of discussions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So let me ask, Sister Laura, obviously as someone who has devoted her life to the church and the causes thereof, talk about approaching this issue of racism as a person of deep faith and as the practice of being part of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. What aspects of your faith come to bear as you find ways to either examine racism and privilege in yourself or in areas of our community?
Yeah, well, you know, racism is a theological construct, right? It is part of our theology. And our Catholic Church, especially the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, has been really clear that racism is a sin, and that to be racist is a sin, but it's also a sin to not act when racism is operative, right? So it's sinful. And if we truly believe that everyone is created in the image and likeness of God, then anything that diminishes that tarnishes that, is hugely problematic. Racism does that, and it goes against God. So really, trying to unseat racism, trying to dismantle racism, is the work of theology. It's what Christians ought to be doing. And I can certainly say, kind of to Jean's point, that it's not just the work of Christians. It's our Jewish brothers and sisters. It's our Muslim brothers and sisters who are also doing this work, because we know that it is not at the heart of what our God is about.
So if we're going to take a quick time out in just a moment, but for those people who are listening to our conversation, Jean, where can people find information about the programs that are upcoming? Where can they find your website?
They can go to www.fscenter.org or like our page on Facebook, and it's just Franciscan Spirituality Center.
All right, our conversation continues. We're visiting today with Jean Pagliaro and Sister Laura Nettles, and we're talking about the Racism and the Cooley Region series that is hosted and sponsored by the Franciscan Spirituality Center. And our conversation continues in just a moment here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. This is Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios, and I'm joined today by Sister Laura Nettles of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration and Jean Pagliaro of the Franciscan Spirituality Center. And I'm glad both of you are here to join us. And let me ask you, Jean, just the center, we're talking about the racism and the Coulee region series that you're going to be hosting online, and we'll show people how to connect with that in just a moment. But that's not the only thing that you're offering online. Really, you've had to migrate most of the pretty much all of what you do is online now. I was looking at the latest email catalog from the center, and it's online, Zoom class, online class. So talk about what that transition's been like the last few months.
Yes. So as the program retreat coordinator, at first it was really painful to watch every single scheduled program and retreat be canceled when everything started happening in March. And so we took a couple of weeks to regroup, and then we purchased a Zoom account that would allow us to do some more of the fancy technical things. And so we have been able to transition almost entirely online for everything. And while there have been some challenges with that, we have really been able to offer almost any kind of program retreat via Zoom format. There are a couple of our support groups that meet weekly over phone, and that has seemed to go pretty well, but the majority of our programming is all online. And so we have been able to do programs such as Artist Prayer online. Our presenter, Mary Thompson, has been very open to relearning teaching style through the computer. And we've had great attendance with that one in particular. We've had people, not only for that program, but other programs and retreats, we've had people from all over the country join us. We've had folks from Alaska, we've had California, Washington, Illinois, Iowa, and that has been a really positive aspect of offering the online programs. The challenges that we continue to face are when we're not meeting in person, especially for some of the retreats that tend to go a little more in depth with people sharing some personal things. It's more difficult to do that when you're online rather than sitting in a circle and being able to read facial expressions a little better. But we're working with that, and we're doing what we can, and we're adapting as best as we can.
Basically, what kind of technology do people need to hook up with most of these classes? Just regular, I mean, if it's good enough to stream YouTube, it's probably going to be good enough to connect to one of the classes?
Yes, and that is what we found. And people can, most people do use Zoom on their laptops or computer, but people have also been able to call in with their phones, and they can participate just like a phone call. They obviously just can't see if we have images, but we accommodate that as best as we can. So we found it pretty simple. We do have an extra security layer, so people will be placed in a virtual waiting room before they join. So we can monitor who's joining, and we have the registration list. People always register ahead of time, and so we keep that very secure.
Keep the spammers out.
Yes.
what other offerings are you? We've talked about the racism class. You talked about the art as prayer class. What other offerings do you have coming up?
So coming up, we have quite a few things in July. We've actually surprised ourselves, and July is usually a quiet month for us, and this is going to be one of our busier months in the last few years. And so one thing that's coming up starting next week is a series called Practices of Invitation and Hope, and it's a 3-session series, one in July, one in August, and one in September. And so these are just invitations to practice in our daily lives, things that can nurture hope, look at courage, and how we can stay steady during difficult times. And so participants are invited to attend all three of those sessions. We also have our monthly, it's called Meditation for Emotional Health. That'll be coming up next week as well. And that is led by Sister Sarah Hennessy, one of our spiritual directors. And she leads a guided meditation. And at the end, there's time for a little bit of small group discussion after that. And like I mentioned before, we have Art is Prayer, which is taught by Mary Thompson, and that this next session will be July 13th, and she's going to be doing a watercolor mandala, and people just need to have their own supplies. Usually it's paint and a paintbrush and paper to participate in that. And then going through the list here, we have another one that we thought would be really good for summer. It's called Playing and Praying with Creation. And again, that's on Zoom. And this will be a chance to come together in the virtual retreat and deepen commitment to care for creation and to engage in practices of nature and to just play a little bit and appreciate what we've been given. Those are just a few things in the next couple weeks.
Interesting. And all that information is available on your website as well.
Yes, correct.
So I want to turn back to this discussion about racism and privilege. And I think it's important to sort of clarify what we're talking about, because a lot of people in our society will conflate racism and prejudice as equal. But we're really in your conversations about racism, Sister Laura, you really indicated that you're talking about racism in its systemic form, that is based in the social construct of how our forebears have put society together in order to disadvantage certain people. And I want to give you a chance to talk about why that issue is important for people to deal with and talk about within themselves, even if they haven't really thought of themselves as quote unquote a racist person or a person who acts regularly out of prejudice.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you started with talking about the difference between racism and prejudice, because I think it's very easy for us as white people to get defensive and say, but, you know, I'm not racist because I have black friends, or I'm a nice person, or I don't judge people based on their skin color. And that's usually a conversation stopper, right? If that's all we get to, then we don't actually get to doing any real work. And that's really what we describe as prejudice, right? That I'm not prejudiced if I don't judge people on skin color. But racism is something that has been around since the founding of our country. And if we're going to do anything about it, we have to kind of get past the personal feelings. Like, we can be nice people who are absolutely involved in a racist system and we don't even see it. And that's where we get into white privilege. Right. And white privilege, I know, has had a lot of pushback. And I think it's because people don't see themselves, you know, I didn't grow up with all this money, so I wasn't privileged. But what we're really trying to help people understand, what I'm trying to help myself understand, is that through nothing that I did on my own, my skin color has afforded me opportunities that my black brothers and sisters have not had. Or my skin color is not the problem when a situation has not gone my way. You know, if I apply for a job and I don't get it, I have never thought twice about my skin color being the reason that I may not have gotten the job, right? Or I never had to speak for my race. You know, these are all things that are part of being privileged because of our skin color. And it's really important that people understand the difference. You know, there's lots of privilege in lots of different classes, and we are all privileged in some ways and not privileged in others. But what our country is trying to get us to see, what our black brothers and sisters who are on the streets asking us desperately to see, is that there is a system that privileges those of us who are white. I think my greatest example of this is driving in a car. Before I was in the convent, I liked to speed. I have to admit, I was a little bit of a speed demon.
No, not you.
I know. Before the convent.
Of course.
And I would get pulled over, right? And everything that ran through my head and my body when I was pulled over were things like, are my parents going to be upset with me? Is this going to cause my insurance to go up? Am I going to be able to pay the ticket? Never, ever in being pulled over did I worry about my physical safety. And, you know, our Black brothers and sisters are saying over and over again, that is an example of privilege. I've been in a car driving with a friend who is Black, who when we lights came on behind us and we pulled over, the cop actually went pious. But my friend was absolutely terrified sitting there in the car that we were getting pulled over. Right? That's an example of how I've done nothing to earn that. But I need to be aware of it, and I need to work on behalf of our Black brothers and sisters to make changes to that.
So if somebody's interested in, I don't know if this is going to work on the radio or whatever, and I'm not talking about some deep, like, spiritual exercise or something like that, but if somebody is interested in doing a short sort of self-examination of areas of privilege in their life or areas where they may be part of a system that involves racism, even if they themselves are not acting out of prejudice, what's something that somebody can do to be introspective and to look for these things?
The art, I always direct people to an article that's freely available online. And the author is Peggy McIntosh. And the article is just called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And it's freely available online. And what she does is she not only explains this, but what she does that's really helpful is list various things that are signs of white privilege. It's kind of like a checklist, and you go through it and you realize in many ways all these things that you never thought about, from really big issues to very small things, like going to Walgreens and buying a Band-Aid and not having to worry about finding a flesh color or skin color Band-Aid. Mm. So it's a wonderful checklist. Again, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack by Peggy McIntosh.
Very interesting. And I want to, before we go, we've just got a short amount of time, but Jean, I want to give you one more time to plug the website where people can find information about this series, Racism and the Cooley Region, and tell them when the conversations are going to be held.
So people can go to www.fscenter.org, and they will find the registration link there. And the first session will be July 14th from 6 to 8 p.m., and then there will be five other sessions, July 28th, 1 to 3 p.m., August 11th, 6 to 8, August 25th, 1 to 3, September 8th, 6 to 8, and then September 22nd, 1 to 3. And we scheduled that intentionally so folks that are able to participate in the evenings can attend, and then also if the daytime works better, there are some sessions.
Is it different content?
The day as well.
Different content to
All
each
different
one of
content, yes,
okay.
That is correct. And so those are just being finalized, and so as soon as we have all of that, we don't have the subsequent dates listed yet for the particular speakers yet, but within the next 2 days or so, we should have all of that up and ready to go.
And what's the website one last time?
fscenter.org.
All right. Jean Pagliaro is with the Franciscan Spirituality Center. Sister Laura Nettles of the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Thank you both very, very much for joining us and contributing so much for our discussion.
Thank you for
having
us.
The invitation.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation again, or if you'd like to stream on demand a previous program, if you've got an idea for a future show or a question you want us to look for the answer to, you can go to our website. It's WPR.org/newsmakers. If you'd like to find the podcast of our show and get it delivered automatically to your podcast device, just go to your favorite platform, search for Newsmakers, and hit subscribe. I appreciate when you do. Thank you very much. My producer is John Davis. Thanks very much, John. For all of us at Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks for listening, and catch us next time on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.